This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Why the $850 million deal soured? CEOs Chuck Swoboda and Infineon's Reinhard Ploss wanted to do the deal, but the regulators didn't. And that's the headline on the front page. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Now what for Cree? Collapse of Wolfspeed sale raises questions about Cree and foreign deals. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. In July 2016, a slew of technology executives gathered at a nondescript room in Durham for a rare press conference. The leaders from Durham LED maker Cree and Infineon, a giant semiconductor company based in Germany, lined up behind a lectern. Infineon CEO Reinhard Ploss, fresh off a plane, bandied about words such as investment and growth. Infineon, a massive company with $6.9 billion in annual revenue, would take an $850 million wager on a legacy Cree division dubbed Wolfspeed, he said. That unit, which would represent less than 1% of Infineon's revenue, would mean more than $500 million in deal proceeds cash Cree could use to shop for its own acquisitions. Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda told the crowd to prepare for Cree 3.0. Armed with a swollen wallet, Cree would seek out smart technologies, perhaps bypassing years' worth of expensive research and development, in its quest to be a fully focused lighting firm. A nimbler Cree could take on major players, from General Electric to Acuity, and it would redefine the way the industry looks at lighting, Swoboda said at the time. He told analysts on an earnings call January 27, If things stay on the current course, we are likely to have some type of an M&A transaction in calendar 2017, but it's certainly not going to happen, at least at this point, before the Wolfspeed deal closes. 2 weeks later, however, a one-page press release sent the stock on a tumble when Cree, citing recent conversations with U.S. regulators, said deal closure was now uncertain. The deal was dead a week later. Both companies said they were pulling out over regulatory concerns. It was a surprise move that underscores the difficult and evolving landscape of international transactions. And while it's still early, it could be a sign of how such deals will be viewed in the Trump administration. The implications for Cree, a major Triangle employer with more than 6,200 employees and a market capitalization of more than $2.6 billion, are significant. Cree, whose executives had hoped to spend their windfall on innovation, suddenly has to pay a $12.5 million breakup fee instead. And Frank Plastina, the board member tapped to run the division 2 years ago, has exited the company. For Cree, there are three courses of action. Hold on to Wolfspeed, try for a spin-out IPO, or sell. And for the Triangle, quickly becoming ground zero when it comes to federally funded advanced semiconductor research, the stakes are high as innovators look toward their own future deals. If a German company is having problems, it's very few companies from other countries that would have a better situation, notes Washington attorney Guillermo Christensen of the Baker Botts firm. Driven by defense. The Wolfspeed division is a 550-person unit based at its own standalone Research Triangle Park campus. To describe Wolfspeed's most recent transistor innovation, John Palmer, chief technology and co-founder of Cree, uses heavy language, the kinds of multisyllabic terminology that, to the non-scientist, might make eyelids droopy. But put simply, he says, their performance is significantly better. It's one in a sea of projects for Wolfspeed, from MOSFET transistor research, technology that could charge electric vehicles of the future, to advanced radar projects aimed at helping NASA protect its space missions from atmospheric debris. And while they're not as flashy as the consumer-priced LED bulbs Cree sells in Home Depot, they were the bedrock of the company for decades. Research in what's called wide bandgap semiconductors has further elevated Wolfspeed's mission in recent years. Wide bandgap semiconductors, made of materials such as gallium nitride, can use 90% less power than the traditional variety operating at higher temperatures. That means the potential to power everything from electric cars to industrial motors by using devices that are smaller, faster, and cheaper. NC State University won a competitive bid for a $140 million research consortium dubbed Power America to advance that technology. Cree, through Wolfspeed, was part of the pitch, and it has been one of its largest beneficiaries, teaming up with John Deere to research more efficient ways to power tractors, among other projects. The same technology that could help future farmers save fuel can also power U.S. defense applications. And that's where U.S. regulators come in, starting with the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. The group, an interagency committee that reviews national security implications of foreign dealings with U.S. companies, can either put its stamp of approval on a transaction or stop it in its tracks. On February 8, Infineon cited conversations with that agency as casting severe doubt on the deal. CFIUS, citing national security risks, had concerns. Baker Botts' Christensen is not surprised that a deal involving gallium nitride would prompt pause. The defense industry has really helped drive this, he says, of the technology. Cree leaders optimistic. Palmer, who co-founded Cree alongside Calvin Carter, John Edmond, and Neil Hunter, declined to specifically comment on the situation. It was surprising and disappointing, considering all the work that went into it, but we are moving on from there and going along our way, he says. Palmore says the unit is being reincorporated into Cree. Palmore says his dedication to the science remains. Even as Cree pivoted to LEDs, Palmer's interest in power devices and radio frequency technology never waned. It's what founded Cree, he notes, recalling how the company came out of Navy-funded radar research, right in Wolfspeed's sweet spot. The next project involved semiconductors, ushering in nearly three decades of efficiency improvements, even as other business lines grew around the unit. Nothing changes on the innovation front for Wolfspeed, he says. In February, his group released yet another complicated-sounding technological milestone. He explains with the passion of a scientist how introducing a 1,200-volt MOSFET, a type of transistor, is a huge performance milestone when it comes to powering future devices, from electric car batteries to futuristic metro rails. It's hard for Palmer to compare the latest innovation to what he was building when he helped found Cree in 1987. When we started, we could make a device that blocked 50 volts, he says. This is literally 1,000 times more current, 20 times more voltage, infinitely more reliable. With more research, he envisions technology like this quite literally powering the future. 10 years from now, I hope we're talking about how anything that uses electricity is using our technology, he says. Cree has a long history with federal projects getting early funding from the Navy to advance its research out of NCSU in the 1980s. Wolfspeed's research has included many major projects for the federal government over the years. Among Wolfspeed's most publicized efforts is a collaboration with defense contractor Lockheed Martin on what has been dubbed Space Fence. In its simplest form, it's a space junk tracking system, Palmer has explained. With some 500,000 objects floating in space, everything from satellite debris to astronaut refuse, the feds were looking for a way to avoid future collisions. So, they've turned to a solid-state radar system powered by a Cree-developed chip, with the Air Force footing part of the bill. If all goes well, a ground-based radar using the technology will be placed on Kwajalein Atoll in the South Pacific, perhaps in 2018. Other Wolfspeed projects have included marine radar research for boats and gallium nitride transistors for cell phone base stations. Cree isn't Infineon's first interaction with CFIUS over these type of concerns. Mixed history of deals. In 2015, Infineon acquired U.S. firm International Rectifier Corporation, a power management technology firm based in California that, as of 2016, had about 40 employees in Morrisville. Products in our IRC's portfolio, like those under the Wolfspeed umbrella, have broad applications from lighting to automobile to defense systems, And similar to when it announced Wolfspeed, Infineon said the acquisition would accelerate its roadmap in advanced semiconductors. IRC, like Wolfspeed, fell under CFIUS review when it came to closing its $3 billion buyout. But it passed with little fanfare under the Obama administration, despite a customer list that counted both NASA and the U.S. military. Asif Anwar, analyst with Strategy Analytics, a Massachusetts-based technology consulting firm, points out that those contracts weren't underpinning a major program at IRC, making it easier for Infineon to separate out the sensitive deals. Given the strong entrenchment of Wolfspeed, Cree technology within certain U.S. defense programs, it would be very difficult for Cree to carry through the acquisition without making some kind of divestment, Anwar says. Baker Botts Christensen, who previously served with both the CIA and the State Department, agrees. While he has no direct connection to Cree or Infineon, it is a case he has tracked because of its implications for the greater power and radio frequency industry. Gallium nitride, the crux of that technology, is found in lots of applications, but especially in some sensitive defense-related applications, he says. Still, such technology sensitivity can sometimes pass regulatory muster. In August, China National Chemical Corporation's bid for Syngenta AG was approved. In February, German firm Osram received approval from CFIUS for the $425.5 million sale of an LED lamps unit to a group of Chinese investors. But contrary examples exist, such as the case in December, when then-President Barack Obama upheld a recommendation by CFIUS to block the $715 million sale of German-based semiconductor equipment supplier Aixtron SE, which has a subsidiary in California, to Chinese firm Grand Chip Investment, GmbH. It marked the second time Obama had blocked a deal on national security grounds, according to media reports. President George H.W. Bush had stopped a Chinese acquisition in 1990. Christensen says it can come down to what companies can be reached. A common one is for an acquirer to put a wall of sorts up around sensitive contracts, where the new parent can get the economic benefits of government deals but not the intellectual property. But in a case like this one, where I suspect Infineon was really hoping to get the technology benefit of buying Cree, if you walled off of their technology, you're losing a lot of the deal value of the business, he says. Christensen says the fact that the U.S. government has invested so much into the technology could have also given regulators pause. He points to a past controversy over a buyout proposal of battery manufacturer A123, which had been awarded up to $250 million in federal funds. One of the concerns was whether the U.S. is actually financing the work for a Chinese company to just come in and buy that research, Christensen says. Was there a Trump effect? While in this case it's a German company, Infineon has suggested the potential for Asian deals. In a recent interview, Plas told European business publication Handelsblatt Global that Infineon was interested in future deals in Asia. But future deal makers should be paying attention to what happens with Cree, says Christensen. If you are a foreign company and you are purchasing a U.S. company that is involved in the production of these materials, you should be very, very careful in analyzing the implications of that, he says. In the triangle, Power America makes the case particularly relevant. When Obama announced the consortium in Raleigh in January 2014, local executives hoped it would transform the region into an innovation mecca for advanced semiconductor technology. Those early partners included names with significant local connections, such as John Deere, Cree, and ABB, which has its North American headquarters in Cary. Christensen says it's possible any deals that they offer up in the coming years might fall under similar scrutiny. Angelo Zeno, analyst with CFRA Research, notes, "It just shows how sensitive things really are right now." Anwar says he doesn't think the Trump administration's stance on foreign investment made a deciding impact, but it might have given regulators pause. If you were in that boardroom looking to make a decision with respect to the acquisition, then perhaps the current focus on Made in America might have pushed you a little bit over the edge, Anwar says. Where does Cree go from here? Anwar calls Cree the biggest loser in the situation. They were keen to offload what they viewed as a marginal business, he says. They want to focus on the lighting sector, and power and RF isn't central and core to that. He says Cree might be forced to spin off the company. The market conditions that kept delaying the IPO could change in 2017, he says. But for now, Cree is taking the discontinued operations label off of Wolfspeed. Zeno says that improves both Cree's margin profile and earnings potential, but he expects Cree to see if they can find another suitor for Wolfspeed. He points to statements Swoboda made in Cree's last earnings call that closing the deal was priority one. Moving backward may be more complicated than they're letting on, he says. But Zeno says this forestalls or limits Cree from being acquisitive. Swoboda has repeatedly said acquisitions were how Cree would round out its lighting portfolio and complete its transformation. Zeno shrugs off rumors Cree itself might be a takeover target. If Cree could have actually successfully sold Wolfspeed, that could have been on the table, he says. When you get rid of Wolfspeed, you have a more nimble, focused company. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. The main headline, U2's Bono didn't find what he was looking for in North Carolina. Looks like Bono and the rest of U2 won't be back in Raleigh after NC State University tried and failed to land a spot in the band's summer tour. Asked about House Bill 2, NCSU Athletics Director Debbie Yao tells Biz the law has had an impact on her department's budget. It has already hurt us, she says. We had a concert lined up that would have been here in June, and they passed on us and went to Louisville. We were in negotiations with them, and as part of the negotiations, they finally got around to talking about HB2 and decided they didn't want to bite this off. The only June concert at the University of Louisville's football stadium is U2, the popular Irish band fronted by its charismatic leader Bono. That Kentucky concert was announced January 30 as part of the band's celebration of the 30th anniversary of the album The Joshua Tree, which contains some of the band's biggest hits. Yao didn't say which act NCSU lost, but Biz has confirmed it was U2. Yao says the concert would have generated at $250,000 for just for the athletics department, and other parts of campus would have benefited as well. U2 played at Carter Finley Stadium in October 2009. Law firm livens up office with art. Brooks, Pierce, McClendon, Humphrey, and Leonard has created its own art gallery, or at least the equivalent of one in its newly renovated office at the Wells Fargo Capital Center. Over the last 8 months, the firm created a collection of North Carolina art by working with galleries in Raleigh and Greensboro, along with local artists directly. Charles Coble, a partner in the Raleigh office, says the collection reflects the firm's North Carolina roots and makes the renovated space more enjoyable. The collection includes pieces from North Carolina artists, including Thomas Sayre, George Beierlein, Herb Jackson, and Paris Alexander. And it features paintings, sculptures, and even tapestry work, says Coble, with some of the pieces depicting famous North Carolina scenes, like a tobacco barn, Yates Mill, and the Capitol. BCBS's Wilson gets a great seat at the table. Brad Wilson, the Chief Executive Officer of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, recently announced his retirement to take effect later this year. But in the meantime, it looks like he is hobnobbing in the right place. On February 27, during President Donald Trump's meeting with health insurance executives at the White House, Wilson was seen sitting right next to Trump for the 40-minute session. So, Biz asked, what was it like to talk to the Prez? That was completely serendipitous, Wilson says. We walked in the room and I saw my name card placed right beside him. Any time for small talk? No, the meeting was scheduled for 10:30 a.m., but he did not come into the room until about 11, says Wilson. We went around for quick introductions before he spoke for a few minutes and then went on to listen to us about the challenges and opportunities we have in addressing healthcare costs. Wilson added that with about 650,000 North Carolinians expected to be under Obamacare, any changes to the system have to be thought out precisely. The thought of these people not having medical insurance simply is troubling and problematic, Wilson says. They win. Main event is next. Band Together, the Triangle group that uses music as a platform for social change, had a successful last band standing on February 25 at Lincoln Theater. Travers Brothers won the event and will join Ben Folds and the London Souls in the main event May 6. Band Together tells Biz it is rapidly approaching its goal of raising $1 million for the YMCA of the Triangle's effort to put a new facility in Southeast Raleigh. King of Barbecue had lasting impact. Bill Ellis thought big, always. He turned a humble Wilson hot dog stand into a mammoth barbecue empire with dozens of vehicles that deliver barbecue across the United States. Ellis, known for his white shirt with his name on it and necklace with a gold pig with diamond eyes, never backed away from a challenge. In the 1980s, he catered a big American Medical Association meeting in Chicago, and he rode with his team's 18-wheeler to deliver the food and guide the big rig. He was all over this event, remembers Kim Whitley, then with the North Carolina Pork Council. It was a challenge, and he loved a challenge. He was rarely deterred, building a business that includes a hog farm, convention center, and catering. He died February 27 at 83, after complications from a broken hip. His funeral was March 2 at 11 a.m., and for one rare day, Bill Ellis Barbecue was closed. Talbots joins Dress for Success push to help women. The local chapter of Dress for Success and Talbots stores are teaming up to help women achieve career goals. Five area stores at Cameron Village, Walnut Street in Cary, Triangle Town Center, South Point, and Eastgate Shopping Center in Chapel Hill will host a clothing donation drive through March 5. Also, 30% of certain sales will go to Dress for Success Triangle. Dress for Success Triangle has served over 11,000 women since its inception, says Beth Briggs, executive director of the local chapter, which began in 2008. The global organization focuses on helping women achieve professional independence, she says, through career and image coaching. Women first get a resume and cover letter through Dress for Success services, and then professional attire through items donated to the organization. Once women land a job, they receive 5 days' worth of professional clothing, Briggs says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Retail Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Large Raleigh Lot to Be New Home for Exploris. A group of Raleigh designers and developers have been working for months on plans for what architect Robbie Ferris says will be the first energy-positive high-rise building in the United States. Well, the first that we know of, Ferris says, by energy-positive, he means that the $70 million 10-story structure planned on a nearly 6-acre site 2 blocks south of the Raleigh Convention Center will produce more energy than it consumes. The City Gateway project will have an exoskeleton of roof and wall-mounted photovoltaic panels along with a ground-sourced geothermal energy storage system. He projects the building will be 60% more efficient than comparable buildings. The goal, he says, is to break ground by July with completion by winter 2018. We just need one more good, strong tenant for the building, he says. City Gateway, located at 120 Kindley Street, is also being designed as a new home for the Explorers School, a K-8 charter school program seeking to combine its middle school on Hillsborough Street and its elementary school on New Bern Avenue into one building. Explorers plans to open a campus on the first floor of the 10-story building, taking about 50,000 square feet. Above will be about 140 square feet of Class A office space, plus a parking deck and rooftop terrace. Market for Class A office space booming across the Triangle. The Triangle region's office market currently has the widest variety of new Class A building offerings under construction than the market has seen in more than a decade. Builders are constructing 13 new Class A buildings in Raleigh, Durham, Cary, Morrisville, and Chapel Hill, plus another three buildings with significant pre-leasing that are expected to break ground in the next few months. The market also has close to a dozen office building projects queued up, with active marketing campaigns by local developers and brokerage firms already underway. Buildings under construction, 2.06 million square feet. Projects announced for 2017, 614,000 square feet. Pre-leased, 1.32 million square feet. And projects proposed, 1.9 million square feet. New steakhouse, Stony River, opens in Chapel Hill. The Nashville, Tennessee restaurant company behind J. Alexander's continues its expansion into North Carolina by debuting another of its brands in the Triangle. On February 27, J. Alexander's Holdings began welcoming guests to its Stony River Steakhouse and Grill at Chapel Hill's University Place Mall, next to the Silver Spot Cinema. The 7,906-square-foot restaurant has seating for about 225 guests and a full-service bar. It is the company's first location for Stony River in North Carolina. It opened its first J. Alexander's restaurant in Raleigh in December. One brewery closing, another will open. The owners of Draft Line Brewing Company in Fuquay Varina will be closing the brewery and tap room on Broad Street on April 28, after a nearly three-year run. But at the same time, Jonathan Pierce, owner of the Mason Jar Tavern restaurants in Holly Springs and Fuquay Varina, has announced he's opening his own brewery and will be reopening the tap room that Draft Line is closing. The new brewery, called Mason Jar Lager Company, will open in late spring or early summer. While we hate to lose one of our favorite watering holes, the Draft Line owners are excited to get to spend more time with their families and enjoy the industry from the other side of the bar again, Pierce wrote in an email to Triangle Business Journal. It has been great working with them, and we will always have a bar stool for them at the Mason Jar. Work begins at Old Raleigh Warehouse. 2 years after the Raleigh City Council chose a plan by local investors and developers to save the historic city-owned Stone's Warehouse building on East Davie Street from ruin, work is finally underway. Jason Queen, lead manager for the $17 million transfer company project, confirms construction is starting for the site of a new grocery market, 15 townhouse units, and a completely refurbished building for a food production hall and market. Queen expects to finish by June 2018. This is one of the last commercial buildings left in this neighborhood, and it's important because it helps connect this neighborhood to the rest of the city, Queen says. The owners of the Saxifaw General Store will anchor a new grocery building. Local vendors who have committed to leasing space in the food production hall include Videri Chocolate Factory, Bolted Bread, and local seafood. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the OnTech Transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. The first headline, Crowded Morrisville Road to Get Help. A cash infusion of more than $6 million puts Morrisville one step closer to a project that officials say will alleviate congestion on one of the town's busiest roads, the Morrisville Carpenter Road Improvement Project. The project, which includes widening that stretch to four lanes, adding curbs, gutters, and sidewalks, and switching out culverts, breaks ground in 2018. After two previous funding cycle rejections, the town has finally secured $6.3 million from what's called the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, or CAMPO, locally administered project program for utility relocation construction. Morrisville will add another $2.7 million to the project, on top of the nearly $2 million it's already funneled into design work and right-of-way acquisitions. Mayor Mark Stolman says he hears complaints about the road weekly. It's such a pain point that, despite the fact that it's a state-maintained road, Morrisville has decided to pour in its own funds to expedite improvements, he says. While it's a small stretch of highway, just 1.3 miles, Stolman insists it's pivotal for commuters from Morrisville, Cary, Apex, and Holly Springs. To go through Morrisville to get to I-40, 540, Research Triangle Park, or even the airport, there are very few east-west roads there, he notes in an interview. The choke point is still set up like it was 150 years ago, a two-lane road. A town study shows about 14,000 vehicles move through the stretch of road daily. Obviously, that number is not going to go down. It's going to grow, says town engineer Rich Coppola. Coppola says Mooresville is already in talks with 10 property owners to obtain additional right-of-ways along a half mile of the project. The remaining road tranche already has enough pavement width, but will be restriped and get a new median. If all goes well, the project could be complete and improving commutes in 2019. Bayer still not detailing how buyout will impact RTP. German chemical company Bayer, which has a significant crop science operation in Research Triangle Park, is, quote, making good progress, unquote, when it comes to closing its planned $66 billion buy of St. Louis agriculture innovator Monsanto. That's according to CEO Werner Baumann, who told analysts on a recent earnings call that the deal is on track to close by the end of 2017. It's a transaction set to shake up RTP, where Bayer, alongside Syngenta, BASF, and Novozymes, has helped create a globally recognized plant science cluster. Scott Johnson, Vice President of Agricultural Biotechnology at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, calls Bayer an absolute cornerstone of the state's high-tech ag community. And we don't see any lessening of that commitment, he says, pointing to Bayer's recent investment in RTP's AgTech Accelerator, an initiative aimed at supporting early-stage plant science innovation. In addition, as a completely focused life science company, they cannot ignore North Carolina's position as a leading cluster in the world. But, he says, change is inevitable. An acquisition of this size requires a hard look at capturing synergies, and we expect some impacts here in RTP as the merger is implemented over the next few years, he predicts. The question is, what impacts? It's a query that, at least publicly, Bayer has yet to answer. Again this week, Baumann reiterated the combined company's commitment to Monsanto's hometown of St. Louis, without mentioning what role RTP might play in that future. Freight numbers highlight NAFTA's impact on North Carolina. As controversy looms over the North American Free Trade Act, new freight numbers show the monetary impact of trade dealings in Canada and Mexico on North Carolina. The U.S. reported about $1.01 trillion in aggregate freight trade with NAFTA nations in 2016, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation. Nearly $17.3 billion of those dealings last year were between North Carolina and NAFTA countries. Now, North Carolina's freight numbers include more than $9.3 billion in exports and more than $7.9 billion in imports involving Canada or Mexico. Rizzo, IBM executive who returned to UNC, dies at 89. Longtime Triangle business leader Paul Rizzo died February 23 at 89. Rizzo, an executive at IBM, later became dean at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School. Rizzo was on a flight to Japan in 1987 with then UNC trustee Richard Jenrett after Rizzo had reached IBM's retirement age of 60. Upon Jenrett's urging, he applied to be business school dean. He was very disciplined in how he made decisions, said Dick Dougherty, former site lead for IBM. When you went to see him, you didn't go in with a nice flowery presentation on some subject. You had to prove your case if you were going to get his support. He helped get IBM to Research Triangle Park, said Bob Eubanks, chairman emeritus and founder of Franklin Street Partners. I remember one time he told me the decision was between Richmond, Virginia and RTP, and of course, he played football at Carolina. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "We really see the offshore market as likely to be something we're paying attention to in the next decade, and we are going to position ourselves to make sure that our natural strengths are ready to go." And that quote is from Frank Burkhartsmeyer, Avangrid Renewable CEO, telling investors last month that the company plans to bid on the planned wind farm off North Carolina's coast. If the bid is successful, it would be the second such project for Avangrid, which recently developed the state's first utility-scale wind farm, currently powering Amazon near Elizabeth City. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. The first headline, Raleigh's BDSI secures major financing. After reacquiring the license to pain management product Belbuca at the beginning of the year, Raleigh's BioDelivery Sciences International has secured up to $75 million in debt financing to aid in commercialization efforts already underway. The company's new senior credit facility with CRG, an investment firm focused in the healthcare space, includes $45 million at closing and up to $30 million in additional funding based on, quote, certain revenue and market capitalization milestones through September 30, 2018, unquote, according to BDSI. It will be used to retire BDSI's existing credit facility and for working capital. With shares of BDSI currently trading around $2 after trading at more than $4 per share in March, debt was the appropriate financing method for Belbuca efforts and runway into 2018, says Mark Sergo, president and CEO of BDSI. For instance, $50 million in equity would have equated to about 25 million shares and hefty dilution, he says. Future success of Belbuca, which BDSI believes can treat chronic pain and help avoid opiate abuse, would potentially allow us not to require another financing, he says. If we do, it would be smaller in size. The company is also pursuing partnerships both in the U.S. and abroad, Sergo says, when it comes to Belbuca, whose reacquisition was announced in December. BDSI recently noted at an investor meeting in New York that the return of Belbuca is expected to push the company to profitability sooner than originally anticipated. On January 6, we inherited a product on very favorable financial terms that ended the year with a $30 million gross sales run rate, Sergo said at the event. This added revenue growth will allow us to bring our commercial business to profitability by the end of the first quarter. Argo stock sinks following recommendation to stop trial on kidney cancer treatment. Durham's Argos Therapeutics saw its stock plummet February 21 after an independent data monitoring committee recommended it discontinue a Phase 3 trial of rocapodensyl T for the treatment of metastatic kidney cancer. In a statement, Argo CEO Jeff Abbey said, "We are extremely disappointed with these results, which included 75% of the targeted events needed to permit the primary analysis and assessment of overall survival in the study. We sincerely appreciate the patients and investigators who have participated in the ADAPT Phase 3 trial and remain convinced in the ability of precision immunotherapy to improve the lives of patients." Argo said it will keep its trial open while talking with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, after which it will make a determination as to the next steps. Quintiles IMS buying back shares from Gillings, other larger shareholders. Quintiles IMS Holdings is repurchasing more than 9.6 million shares of its common stock in a private transaction for $750 million, the company stated February 24. The shares are being sold by principal shareholders, including funds affiliated with TPG Global, 7,561,013 shares, and Leonard Green & Partners, 1,116,407 shares, Quintiles founder Dennis Gillings and certain affiliates, 1 million shares. Currently, Gillings owns 12.76 million shares, or almost $1 billion in Quintiles IMS stock. TPG Global owns almost 50 million shares of company. Leonard Green owns about 7.3 million shares of Quintiles IMS. Chapel Hill Sempra cuts workforce by 67%. Following the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's rejection of its pneumonia drug in December, Chapel Hill-based Sempra announced February 28 that it has reduced its workforce by 67% from 136 to 45 employees. We expect our research and corporate expenses to trend significantly downward beginning in the second quarter of this year, and we expect to reduce second half 2017 expenses by more than 70%, the company said. In the fourth quarter, the company reported a net loss of $31.4 million, or 60 cents per share, in comparison to a net loss of $21.2 million, or 48 cents per share, for the same quarter of 2015. Revenue tops $1 billion at Inc. Research in 2016. Inc. Research topped $1 billion in annual revenue for the first time in 2016. However, the company noted some headwinds to its 2017 revenue guidance during its earnings call February 28. Inc. Research delivered a solid performance during the quarter in several key areas, growing net service revenues by 9% and adjusted EPS by approximately 24%. We also were pleased to achieve two key milestones for the full year, surpassing $1 billion in net service revenue for the first time in Inc.'s history, and wrapping up the year with a backlog of approximately $2 billion, CEO Alastair McDonald said. While we are proud of these accomplishments, new business in the quarter was lower than anticipated due to a delayed client decisions with regard to some of our pending proposals, which negatively impacted awards, he said. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the viewpoint page for the Editor's Notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Very Little Faith in HB2 Compromise Talks. A few months ago, I wrote in this very space that regardless of who wins the governor's race in North Carolina, the state's House Bill 2 law will be repealed. Now I'm beginning to have my doubts. Despite what many would argue, HB 2 is not helping efforts to recruit industry to the state. People in the business make that very clear. In some cases, HB 2 has cost outfits real dollars. Just read the piece on U2 choosing to go to Louisville instead of performing at Carter-Finley Stadium. School officials say that cost the university at least $250,000, money that could have been used for athletic and student-related activities. What seems clear is there is a widening gap of understanding and acceptance between stakeholders living in the metro areas and ones living in our rural counties. Our newly elected governor, Roy Cooper, wants the law gone, and so do some legislators. But there are not enough of them because the House and Senate leadership believe their constituents are not ready for a full repeal. So how does one convince House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger to take control of the conversation for a repeal? Nothing suggests there is an interest in having forward-thinking discussions, and that's a shame for North Carolina. Although the state's business groups have held meetings stating they support a compromise on the law, it does not look like they have been successful in moving the needle. And that leads me to believe there may just be only one solution, a broader campaign targeting our rural communities to show the real impact HB2 has had on North Carolina. But I am not sure entities that have shied away from bringing their business or their events to the state because of HB2 would identify themselves in fear of retaliation. In most cases, what we have are anecdotes, and that's simply not powerful enough. What we need are faces that tie to the issue. What we need are companies and organizations explaining to all North Carolinians what they fear about HB2. What the Human Rights Campaign or Cooper or the Charlotte Mayor say is not resonating with the broader public, who sees this as political rhetoric. Neither will comments from Bruce Springsteen, Pearl Jam, or U2 matter in this case. We need the folks who claim they would not come to North Carolina to step up and tell us the pitfalls of HB2. Don't use the Chamber, Visitors Bureau, and Convention Center as your mouthpiece. Say it yourself loud and clear. If we can't get there, this bickering, cloaked in ideological differences, will continue with no end in sight. I would love to be wrong, however. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have an article, a Viewpoint column written by Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow at the Bryan School of Business and Economics at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. The headline, U.S. Labor Markets Return to Normalcy. We often hear that labor markets are still dysfunctional, 7 years after they hit bottom in early 2010. This was one of President Donald Trump's recurring themes on the campaign trail last year, which he supported with bizarrely inaccurate numbers, such as his claim that the real unemployment rate was actually 42%. More recently, Trump's new Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, told senators during his confirmation hearing that the published unemployment rate isn't real, the real rate is higher. But it's not just Trump and his people. A recent article in Bloomberg Businessweek claimed that in spite of our so-called full employment, many people are being left behind as the economy improves. These claims have the ring of truth. The job situation doesn't feel as strong as it did before the Great Recession. However, the reality is that U.S. labor markets are closer to normal than many of us realize, and perhaps that's the real problem. The new normal isn't great. To what degree are labor markets actually leaving people behind? The so-called headline unemployment rate, designated U3 by the federal government, is the one reported in the news. The government also publishes a more inclusive measure called U6, which adds in, quote, marginally attached workers, unquote, and those in part-time jobs, quote, for economic reasons, unquote. Contrary to what some critics claim, U6 isn't the real unemployment rate. Both U3 and U6 are real and valid. They measure different things. Workers with a part-time job for economic reasons would prefer a full-time job and hence are underemployed. Marginally attached workers aren't actively looking for work and hence aren't considered unemployed, but they've looked for a job in the last 12 months and would take a job if one were offered. They're ready to work. Therefore, the gap between U6 and U3 is a reasonable measure of the share of our workforce that's been left behind. It's an imperfect measurement for mathematical reasons, but it'll do the job here. At the worst point of the economic downturn, U6 rose to more than 17%, while U3 was itself quite high at 10%. That 7-point gap was the biggest in recent business cycles. The gap is now around 4.5 points, which isn't good, but it hovered around 4 points throughout the 2001 to 2007 expansion. We're close to normal. The situation looks slightly better in North Carolina, where the U6-U3 gap is about 4.5 points, but that's about the same as during the last expansion. Wage increases provide another important indicator. For a few years, the historically large number of marginally attached and underemployed part-time workers helped employers keep wage gains to a minimum. But in the last year, we've started seeing increases of around 3% per year. That's not great, but it implies that our workforce in waiting is shrinking. There are other signs of a return to normalcy in labor markets. The quit rate is still rising, which is encouraging because workers tend not to quit jobs in large numbers unless other prospects are available. The employment population ratio for the prime working age population, people aged 25 to 54, is 78% and closing in on the peak of 80% that was reached in the last expansion. I'm not saying that happy days are here again, just that the labor side of the economy is finally looking up. Yes, workers are being left behind, though at about the same rate as in recent expansions. That's not a ringing endorsement, but right now, it's all we've got. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the news from around the state. First headline, Food Lion upgrading 93 stores across the Triad. Food Lion is stepping up its game as Lidl and Publix enter the Triad. Food Lion announced February 27 it would spend $178 million in 93 stores across the Triad, spokesman Matthew Herrickel said. The investment includes remodeling the stores, additional price investments throughout the year, and investments in associates and the community through its Food Lion Feeds program. We're proud to have been a part of the Greater Triad community since 1968 and are excited to bring our newest format to this market, Food Lion President Meg Hamm said in a release. We look forward to making significant investments in our stores, our customers, our associates, and our communities to offer a new grocery shopping experience. The Salisbury-based chain had shown signs of gearing up for an impending battle before the announcement. Renovations on several Triad stores have either been made or are underway. Herrickel said Food Lion has no plans to open additional stores in the Triad market. Food Lion's announcement comes as Little prepares to enter the Triad with at least 8 stores, including one off Peters Creek Parkway, slated to open by the summer. Publix opened its first Triad store in Winston-Salem in the Ardmore area in 2016. Other stores are in the works in Clemens and High Point. According to the release, the changes will allow customers to take advantage of easier, faster shopping and expanded selections, including more local products, natural and organic items, and healthier snack options. Though Publix may be more of a threat to upscale North Carolina-based chains Lowe's Foods and Harris Teeter, Little is generally regarded as a more direct competitor to Food Lion, Aldi, Walmart, and some smaller discount grocers. American Airlines offers cheap fare for some Charlotte routes. Charlotte Douglas International Airport is among 4 hubs American Airlines selected to roll out its new lowest-cost, no-frills fares in March. Flights between Charlotte and Orlando and Philadelphia are among 10 direct domestic routes that passengers can receive ticket discounts in exchange for reduced travel options when flying with American. Charlotte is the second-largest hub for Fort Worth, Texas-based American. The world's largest carrier operates nearly 90% of flights at Charlotte Douglas. These routes were chosen because they provide a variety of competitive situations, says American. Also, this mix of hubs and other cities is a good fit for preparing our airport operation for basic economy. A search on American's website shows customers can expect savings of $40 when purchasing a round-trip basic economy ticket over the main cabin fare. From Charlotte to Orlando, basic economy fare costs $162 versus $202 in the main cabin for travel between March 1 and 8. ABC's Shark Tank to hold auditions in Charlotte. ABC's Shark Tank is coming to Charlotte for auditions this spring. The show features entrepreneurs and inventors pitching their business ideas to a panel of tough investors, including Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban and real estate mogul Barbara Corcoran. Shark Tank will host a casting call in Charlotte in April. Shark Tank hosts open calls around the country where entrepreneurs take 1 minute to pitch their businesses, products, and ideas to a member of the casting team. In April, Shark Tank will host one of these open calls at Central Piedmont Community College. Cycle Bar continuing to expand Charlotte studios. Cycle Bar says it will expand its footprint to Lake Norman with a location at 20601 Torrance Chapel Road in Cornelius. Cycle Bar will open its second location in the Charlotte market next month. That site will open March 9. It will mark the opening by giving away 2,500 free rides. Advance registration is required, says owner Courtney Stokowski. That location is one of 200 Cycle Bar studios slated to open across the country by the end of 2017. Cycle Bar currently operates a location in Charlotte's Midtown. A third location is planned in South Charlotte. And with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the small business section and read as much as we can of Jim Verdonick's column. Jim Verdonick is an attorney at Ward & Smith PA in Raleigh and the author of Crowdfunding, A Legal Guide to Investment in Platform Regulation. The headline, March Madness Can Be a Valuable Tool for Businesses. How much time will your team members spend filling out March Madness brackets? 1 hour or more for the multi-bracket players? Every year, brackets decrease business productivity even for people who aren't regular college basketball fans. You have 4 choices on a policy. Try to stamp out March Madness brackets on company time, ignore brackets as a harmless distraction, run an office bracket to boost employee morale, or use brackets to learn about your business. Don't waste such a powerful tool. Think about ways to use it to learn about your business. First, acknowledge that your team probably knows a lot about your business that you don't. You can't be everywhere. You don't know everything that happens every day. But collectively, your team is everywhere and knows everything. Big data is a hot business topic, but small data in the head of an employee three cubicles down or on the loading dock may hold the key to the future of your business. Do you know the biggest reason valuable data gets stuck in employees' heads? It's simple. No one asks them what they know. Those who do ask often get poor results because they don't know how to ask effective questions or how to motivate employees to think. Modern managers often spend more time trying to develop idiot-proof systems than on challenging employees to think and communicate what they think. Idiot-proof systems create idiots. Brackets are valuable tools because brackets require strategy, analysis, and comparison. Completing a March Madness bracket requires dozens of choices in a short time frame. How often do you ask your employees to do that? So create your own brackets about your business. Ask each team member to fill out a bracket. Do you know what your employees think about your biggest challenges and potential solutions? How are you wasting money? Which customers should you target or upsell? What do customers like or hate the most? Use bracket games to find out what your team thinks. The really interesting answers will start showing up in the Sweet 16, the Elite 8, the Final Four, and the Final Game. If some choices pop up many times in the final rounds, ignore them at your own peril. Share the results. Encourage employees to discuss the reasons for their choices. And, of course, you need prizes. What if your team gets it wrong? In that case, you have a big problem because you haven't taught your team how your business is supposed to work. Instead of a team, you have a group of robots. Or you may have a bigger problem in that maybe you don't know how your business actually works. Maybe your team is right. Either way, you need to fix it. Good luck with your brackets. And finally, we'll turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Elizabeth Harrison, branch manager and title counsel at Fidelity National Title. For the past 20 years, Elizabeth Harrison has run her own Raleigh law firm as a commercial and residential transactional lawyer. Now, in a move she sees as an opportunity for a change to initiate growth as a real estate attorney, she has joined Fidelity National Title as head of its Raleigh office. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.